This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذي صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The EU foreign policy chief says the bloc supports the return of the United States to the 2015 nuclear deal. A third member of U.S. President Donald Trump's cabinet resigns in reaction to last week's breach of the Capitol. And Venezuela describes joint war games by the U.S. and Guyana as a, quote, great threat to the region. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmati, and these are our top stories this hour. The EU foreign policy chief says a 27-member bloc supports the return of the United States to the Iran nuclear deal once President-elect Joe Biden enters the Oval Office.
We express our support to intensive diplomacy with the goal of facilitating a U.S. return to the JCPOA and Iran's return to full JCPOA implementation. We welcome President-elect Biden's positive statements on the JCPOA and look forward to working with the incoming U.S. administration.
In a statement, Borrell claimed the EU upheld its commitments under the deal, including sanctions lifting after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Tehran has repeatedly slammed the European signatories for not fulfilling their commitments. Iran started to scale back its commitments under the deal and recently started enriching uranium to 20% purity level. Meanwhile, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency warned that Iran's higher enrichment of uranium means that there are, quote, weeks left to salvage the agreement. Political commentator Ian Williams says the Biden administration will be under intense pressure from the Israeli lobby not to return to the Iran nuclear deal.
I think there's going to be a lot of give and take and jockeying But these negotiations have never been easy. The Europeans are not a pushover. I mean, you know, the Germans and the others were very strong on Iran at the time. I remember when this whole issue first came up. They were not pushovers and not pro-Iranian, but they were trying to get a realistic deal that protected everybody's interests and trying to resist immense pressure from the United States at the same time. And, of course, we know that they didn't resist that pressure. They didn't produce a working mechanism to bypass American sanctions. So it's, I think there's still a lot of negotiation and tugging and heaving, but I think there'll be a lot more goodwill. But you should also remember that Joe Biden's cabinet, like anything else in America, is filled with people who listen to what Israel says for their political futures. Not nearly as much as before, since Trump has run away with the Israel lobby. It means the Israel lobby is sort of scratching its head now and thinking, whoops, did we back the wrong horse? Well, they did. But whether that has practical, real political consequences in Washington is another story.
Families of five Iranian nuclear scientists who were assassinated over the past decade have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government. Their legal team says Washington is the main force behind the serial killings that aim to derail Iran's nuclear energy program. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed the lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
Yesterday, we presented the case to Iran's Shahid Beheshti Court for International Affairs. Of course, the case will demand that those culpable in the killing of the nuclear scientists face justice. Such a case is not unprecedented, since the U.S. has for several times taken a similar path against our government and froze our government's foreign assets.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but it is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's criminal agenda. If finalized, the case will lead to the seizure of $100 million of U.S. assets in foreign banks.
The legal action comes over a month after the assassination of top Iranian nuclear figure Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which, as in the previous incidents, Iran blames on Israel. Israel has a history of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth victim. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the killings, its footsteps can be tracked. In video recorded in 2018, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Coupled with the EU's lack of commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, the assassination of Fakhrizadeh made Iran change its policy with regards to its nuclear program. In response, the Islamic Republic officially announced that it resumed enriching uranium at 20% purity, markedly distancing from the 3.67% cap set by the nuclear deal. The legal team here says the lawsuit against the U.S. pursues a single goal: to break the chain of its unlawful targeting of its key scientists. However, while the five slain scientists are viewed as the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry, officials say the sector is up and running. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has said that he is stepping down. He is the third cabinet official to quit his job in the aftermath of the attack that comes amid a growing list of resignations by White House aides. In the meantime, counterterrorism prosecutors have opened probes into Wednesday's storming of Congress. The raid claimed at least six lives, including two police officers. Federal authorities have made dozens of arrests on several charges, including domestic terrorism. The FBI has also warned law enforcement forces of more armed protests being planned for Washington, D.C. and 50 U.S. capital cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration, scheduled for January the 20th.
Number of extremists.
Former CIA counterterrorism officer John Kiriakou says supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump are still planning a coup.
What we're looking at here is a very well coordinated 50-state uprising. I wrote an article today, an op-ed today, calling this a coup. And the reason why I call it a coup, or at least a coup attempt, is that any intelligence analyst from any other country, when looking at the facts, would also call it a coup attempt. This is, we've had a democratically held election. The challenger won. The incumbent refused to accept the fact that he had lost. He called his supporters out. Those supporters converged on Washington with Molotov cocktails and weapons and handcuffs in order to arrest the Speaker of the House and the Senate Minority Leader. What else can you call it but a coup? Well, it didn't work last Wednesday. And so what these same people are doing is they're organizing similar uprisings in all 50 states, at all 50 state capitals, and challenging all 50 governors. If that isn't a coup attempt, I don't know what is. Now, one of the things that I think the FBI is just now starting to focus on is the fact that many of these people who are supporting an uprising are people who are current members of the military. They are current members of the police. They are current government employees in organizations like the FBI or the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Defense. Those are the people that we need to be worried about, because they are working against constitutionalism from the inside, and that's the most dangerous.
The Democratic lawmakers in the U.S. Congress are expected to kick off an impeachment process against the president following a deadly attack on the Capitol building by pro-Trump protesters. They accuse the president of inciting the riots, Brian Curvello reports.
The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives is expected to consider launch an impeachment process against the U.S. president on Wednesday. The Democratic lawmakers say they will move ahead with the measure if Vice President Mike Pence refuses to invoke the 25th Amendment, an article that would immediately unseat the president if he is deemed unfit for office.
That's going to be very difficult to achieve, one, because I don't think Vice President Pence is inclined to do so, probably viewing it as political suicide for his future in case he wants to run for president in the future. So I don't think that one's likely. In the context of impeachment, it is a political process. And right now, I think the will is there by the Democratic Party, and it seems like even some Republicans may be interested.
So far, we've seen an unwillingness of Pence, in particular, to move forward with the 25th Amendment, and Trump, of course, is not taking responsibility or taking it upon himself to resign, as he has been called upon to do. So I'm not surprised that impeachment is likely to be the result.
Democrats and a few Republican lawmakers are calling for Trump's removal from office, citing his conduct and rhetoric. Experts say the lack of bipartisan balance in the calls, however, can put U.S. national security at risk.
I think there's certainly a risk of something atrocious happening. I hope, hearing that Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, has been in contact with Pentagon officials, there may be some checks, but it does reveal somewhat of a danger in our process in terms of how powerful the executive is, and maybe we should think about that in future.
The longer he remains in office, he still has access to all kinds of classified information and security codes. He has been isolating himself, which elevates the level of uncertainty about his actions in the coming days and weeks. So, yeah, I think there's definitely reason to be concerned about our overall security.
Last week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi underlined the urgency to remove Trump by speaking with Pentagon officials about safeguards of the president's access to the nuclear codes in the last days of his presidency. To make matters worse for Trump, the U.S. Department of Justice hasn't ruled out filing charges of insurrection, sedition, and attempted coup against him. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Curvello.
Venezuela has strongly denounced joint naval war games by the U.S. and Guyana, calling the maneuvers, quote, a great threat to the region.
This represents, and I see it, a great threat to the region, which all Latin American and Caribbean countries must see, must observe, and must witness, because today it's Venezuela, and tomorrow it could be any country in the region.
Venezuela's Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino made these remarks during a joint press conference with Vice President Delcy Rodriguez in the capital, Caracas. Rodriguez, for her part, called the drills an attempt by the outgoing administration of U.S. President Donald Trump to create provocations and threats. Guyana and Venezuela are locked in a border dispute for over a century. The new flare-up coincides with the installation of a new government-controlled National Assembly in Caracas, replacing the opposition-controlled legislature backed by the U.S. Cuba has slammed as a political opportunism Washington's new sanctions and its decision to designate the Caribbean nation as a state sponsor of terrorism. In a Twitter post, the Cuban foreign minister condemned what he called the cynical and hypocritical qualification of Cuba announced by Washington. It is after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that he is placing Cuba back on the blacklist, adding that it sends a clear message to Havana to end its support for international terrorism and subversion of U.S. justice. The move is a reversal of an Obama-era decision and makes it harder for President-elect Joe Biden to quickly revive diplomatic ties with Havana. Since taking office in 2017, President Donald Trump has clamped down on Cuba by tightening travel restrictions and imposing sanctions, citing different pretexts. Biden has, however, said that he would promptly reverse Trump's policies on Cuba. Political commentator Gloria Estela Lariva says Washington's policy on Cuba over the past 60 years shows the U.S. is the real state sponsor of terrorism.
Move by the U.S. to declare Cuba, return it to the list of state sponsors of terrorism, is absolutely cynical and ridiculous. It's the hypocrisy of the U.S. because everybody knows that Cuba is not sponsoring terrorism, that in fact it is the U.S. since the very beginning of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. The U.S. has sponsored, armed, financed, and given shelter to terrorists who have attacked Cubans on the island and in diplomatic missions abroad. More than 3,470 Cubans have been murdered, and 2,099 have been injured seriously by U.S. terrorism. In fact, the U.S. gave shelter to two of the most notorious terrorists in the Western Hemisphere. In all these 60 years, the U.S. has used biological warfare, spraying biological contaminants over the island, causing the death of hundreds, bombings of buildings in the island, bombing Cuban embassies and consulates in other countries, killing diplomats there, and most of all, carrying terrorism out in Cuba.
Now, France's coronavirus infections and related hospitalizations are increasing. The country's seven-day moving average of new cases now stands at over 18,000, a seven-week high. The latest surge in cases comes as France is grappling with a more contagious variant of the disease that was first detected in Britain. The government is now considering a third national lockdown and wants to extend a now enforced curfew to all parts of the city, the country, that is. In Germany, officials registered over 12,000 new cases and 340-plus more deaths. The country is now under a nationwide lockdown, with officials warning about the hardest phase
of the pandemic in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister says that his country is racing against time to roll out COVID vaccines as the number of deaths are recording or hitting records high.
It's a race against time because we can all see the threat that our NHS faces, the pressure it's under, the demand in intensive care units, the pressure on ventilated beds, even the shortage of oxygen in some places.
Johnson further said that his country is facing a very perilous moment. The British finance minister also warned that the economy would get worse before it gets any better. Rishi Sunak said more than 250,000 small firms could go bust this year. Britain's coronavirus death toll currently stands at over 81,000, which is the world's fifth highest tally. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished,
give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Limelight. America's 21st century wars have been tragedies for millions and have led to a proliferation of threats that damage the United States in fundamental ways, says Nick Terse, writer, in an article titled, On the 20th anniversary of the so-called War on Terror, is there any end in sight? Stay tuned, please, for the details. This is a different kind of war, which we will wage aggressively to disrupt and destroy terrorist activity, U.S. President George W. Bush announced a little more than 2 weeks after 9/11 attacks. Some victories will be won outside of the public view, in tragedies avoided and threats eliminated. Other victories will be clear to all. This year will mark the 20th anniversary of the so-called War on Terror, including America's undeclared conflict in Afghanistan. Despite neither a clear victory nor the slightest evidence that enduring freedom had ever been imposed on that country, U.S. combat operations in Afghanistan ended, according to the Defense Department in 2014. In reality, that combat simply continued under a new name, Operation Freedom's Sentinel, and grinds on to this very day. Like the 2003 invasion of Iraq, known as Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom and Freedom's Sentinel failed to live up to their names. Nor did any of the monikers slapped on America's post-9/11 wars ever catch the public imagination. The battlefields spread from Afghanistan and Iraq to Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, Syria, Niger, Burkina Faso, and beyond, at a price tag north of $6.4 trillion and a human toll that includes at least 335,000 civilians killed and at least 37 million displaced from their homes. Meanwhile, those long-promised clear victories never materialized, even as the number of terrorist groups around the world proliferated. What the future will bring in terms of this U.S. many armed conflicts is murkier than ever as the Trump administration pursues an array of 11th-hour efforts interpreted as last-minute attempts to make good on pledges to end this country's endless wars or simply as sour grapes shots at upending, undermining and sabotaging the deep state, the CIA in particular, while handcuffing or kneecapping the incoming Biden administration's future foreign policy. For 4 years, the Trump administration has waged a multi-front war, not only in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and elsewhere around the globe, but with the Pentagon as well. Donald Trump entered the White House vowing to stop America's ceaseless foreign interventions and repeatedly teased ending those endless wars. He didn't. Instead, he and his administration continued to wage America's many conflicts, surge troops into Afghanistan and Syria, and threaten nuclear strikes against enemies and allies alike. When the president finally began making halting gestures toward curtailing the country's endless conflicts and attempt to draw down troops in various war zones, the Pentagon and State Department slow-walked, slow-rolled, and stymied their commander-in-chief, deceiving him. For example, when it came to something as basic as the actual number of U.S. troops in Syria. Far from ending endless wars, President Trump escalated the most endless of them. The conflicts in Afghanistan and Somalia, where America has been intermittently involved since 1970s and 1990s, respectively. Airstrikes in Somalia have, for instance, skyrocketed under the Trump administration. From 2007 to 2017, the U.S. military conducted 42 declared air attacks in that country. Under President Trump, 37 strikes were conducted in 2017. 48 in 2018, and 63 in 2019. Last year, U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, acknowledged 53 airstrikes in Somalia, more than during the 16 years of administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. The reasons for that increase remain shrouded in secrecy. The uptick in airstrikes has been disastrous for civilians. While Africa Command recently acknowledged 5 deaths of non-combatants in Somalia from all such airstrikes, an investigation by Amnesty International found that in just 9 of them, 21 civilians were killed and 11 others injured. According to the UK-based monitoring group, Air Wars, evidence suggests that as many as 13 Somali civilians have been killed by US strikes in 2020 alone. And Trump's recent decision to withdraw U.S. forces from there will not end those air attacks, much less America's war, according to the Pentagon. While a change in force posture, this action is not a change in U.S. policy, reads a Defense Department statement that followed Trump's withdrawal order. The U.S. will retain the capability to conduct targeted counterterrorism operations in Somalia and collect early warnings and indicators regarding threats to the homeland. The war in Afghanistan has followed a similar trajectory under President Trump. Far from de-escalating the conflict, as it negotiated a peace deal with the Taliban and pursued troops withdrawal, the administration ramped up the war on multiple fronts, initially deploying more troops and increasing its use of U.S. air power. As in Somalia, civilians suffered mightily, according to a recent report by Netta Crawford of Brown University Cost of War Project. During its first year in office, the Trump administration relaxed the rules of engagement and escalated the air war in an effort to gain leverage at the bargaining table. In all, The unit killed at least 51 civilians in Afghanistan's Wardak province between December 2018 and December 2019. As Akhtar Mohammed Tahriri, the head of Wardak's provincial council, told Quality, "The Americans step on all the rules of war, human rights, all the things they said they'd bring to Afghanistan." After losing his bid for re-election in November, the U.S. president did issue a series of orders drawing down some troops from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Virtually all military personnel are to be withdrawn from Somalia. There, however, according to the Pentagon, some or all of those forces will simply be repositioned from Somalia into neighboring countries in order to allow cross-border operations, not to speak of continuing targeted counterterrorism operations in that country. This suggests that the long-running U.S. air war will continue uninterrupted. The same goes for other war zones where American troops are slated to remain, and no cessation of airstrikes has been announced. News reports indicated that the Department of Defense is reviewing its support for the CIA. The reason former and current administration and military officials told Defense One was to determine whether special operations forces should be diverted from the agency's counterterrorism operations to missions related to competition with Russia and China. The New York Times suggested, however, that the true response could be to make it difficult for the CIA to conduct operations in Afghanistan. The troop drawdowns and 11th-hour policy changes have been cast by pundits and national security establishment boosters as the spiteful final acts of a lame-duck president. Whatever they may be, they also represent a genuine opportunity for a president-elect who has voiced support for a shift in national security policy. Almost two decades after President George W. Bush launched a different kind of war, more than a decade after President Barack Obama entered the White House, promising to avoid stupid wars while promising to win the right war in Afghanistan, 6 months after President Trump committed to ending the era of endless wars, as President Bush put it in 2001, some victories will be won outside of public view, in tragedies avoided and threats eliminated. America's 21st century wars have instead been tragedies for millions and have led to a proliferation of threats that damage the United States in fundamental ways. Failed forever wars are, however, also a Joe Biden legacy. As a senator, he voted for that 2001 AUMF, the 2002 AUMF, and then seconded a president who expanded America's overseas interventions. And nothing in his personal history suggests that he will take the bold actions necessary to follow through on putting an end to America's overseas conflicts.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limit and neutralize Hashd al-Sha'bi's activities with full respect. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy made this decision to get rid of Al-Rafidain Alliance in Iraq.
Dark rooms.
Introduction of Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy is based in Washington, D.C. This institute is a kilometer away from the White House. It is called the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This institute was established in 1985. Its mission statement says that it seeks to advance American interests in West Asia. Who is Martin Indyk? He's Jewish. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was the former research assistant in American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to Israeli regime for two terms, articulated the quote-unquote dual containment strategy for Iran and Iraq.
Israel is getting the benefit of that growing recognition and acceptance in the Arab world, which started with Egypt and the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, and has advanced all of this time in which we've been talking about the travails with the Palestinians, the relations with the Arab states grown and developed.
Martin Indyk is a British-born Jew who is now an American citizen. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy to serve American interests and policies in West Asia. He is the only non-American to have reached the rank of ambassador. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to the Israeli regime for two terms, serving the United States and Israel at the same time. He's a member of the U.S. National Security Council. He received confidence vote from both main U.S. parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. He was also a key member in Camp David Accords. He has dedicated a 40-year effort to paving the way for peace and reconciliation in West Asia, and he makes it as clear as possible that over the past 40 years, he has been absolutely convinced that compromise or peace is possible in West Asia.
For 35 years, I've been essentially devoted my life to trying to achieve a secure peace for Israel.
Martin Indyk introduced the quote-unquote dual containment strategy for Iran and Iraq. He believed in the theory of dual containment during the presidency of Bill Clinton. According to this theory, in order to serve the interests of Israel, they had to build an economic and technological fence to change the governments in Iraq and Iran so that the countries of the region would not follow them.
I think makes them very nervous, and that's why the Prime Minister is coming out much more vocally than one might have expected in the midst of an election campaign here. Saying, you know, we need reassurances, we need red lines against the Iranians, because from his point of view, that's the greatest threat they face.
Now, and after the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy advises its policymakers to either consider introducing a new leader,
far from Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis's ideas or dissolving Hashd al-Sha'bi. Another suggestion is to focus on limiting its organization and filling the vacancy of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis with a person based on their taste. Of course, the group's patience for achieving their goals is so great that the founder of this think tank spent 35 years of his life realizing the idea of creating Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates.
I went back into government to work with Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama again to try to negotiate a final status agreement for the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. So it was a kind of continuation of that effort, continuation of 35 years of obsession on my part with trying to find a way to achieve a peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Michael Knights is another Washington think tank expert who is known for his occasional travels to Iraq. He had previously said that they need someone like General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq to unite their forces and integrate and use all the instruments of their national power. From the Washington Institute's point of view, now is the time for the unification of American forces after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, provided that Hashd al-Sha'bi would be contained and weakened shortly and dissolved and surrendered at a future date. Hashd al-Sha'bi is currently based on a reasonably weak organizational framework and consists of less than 20 pages of law related to public, general executive orders issued to people, and cabinet decisions. This view will change if the Iraqi government implements existing laws and regulations, such as Military Service and Retirement Law No. 3 of 2010, or the Military Penal Code No. 19 of 2007. The Sha'bi forces must be respectfully contained. In the second step of the scenario, this group must be stripped of its spiritual identity and replace livelihood with religious laws and religion. In the Washington Institute version, membership in Hashd al-Sha'bi with certain rights is the key to monitoring a Rafidin Lions. Until the membership of Hashd is defined, fixed, and transparent, any audit of the behavior of its member will be difficult. If and when comprehensive audits are undertaken, they must be done by an independent body, not the Hashd itself. Hashd al-Sha'bi's three operational units, including local units, units stationed in southern Iraq, and finally, wandering units, must not comment negatively about the occupation, and this is to contain Hashd al-Sha'bi respectfully. Dashed leadership acts like a parallel state. It runs a parallel judicial system and prisons, a parallel illicit economy, and a parallel war effort that undermines unity of command across the entire Iraqi security forces. The Washington think tank strategy is to stop growing power of Hashd al-Sha'bi in the first place in order to mobilize all elements of power in Iraq, including the government and authority against them. The think tank's final goal is to create a united front against the existence of Hashd al-Sha'bi, including all the countries that have interests in Iraq. Of course, it takes about 5 to 10 years to realize this idea. Firstly, Hashd al-Sha'bi's growing power must be stopped. At this stage, Hashd al-Sha'bi's activities, its budget and institutional infrastructure are still limited and they must stay at the same level. Undoubtedly, the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis provided an opportunity in this case. This opportunity was realized by concentrating too much power among a limited number of commanders of Hashd al-Sha'bi, provided that the Iraqi government, Islamic seminaries, and international powers come together. Although the plan of Hashd al-Sha'bi's respectful restraint is defined in the long run, but it tries to seize the opportunities. According to the plan, it would be preferable to start the operation by changing the form and structure, first by changing the logo of Hashd al-Sha'bi. Afterwards, a hero approved by the government and the authority is introduced and supported as the new leadership of Hashd al-Sha'bi. Finally, the plan suggests the integration of Hashd al-Sha'bi units, so there will be changes in the structure of the popular mobilization units. So they would just play the role of a unit defending one of the small holy places. In this way, Hashd al-Sha'bi will be respected and its identity will be emptied. Start your work by changing the structure and form. In the first step, start changing Hashd al-Sha'bi's logo with a foreign version. Then, activate and strengthen a reform hero with the support of the Iraqi Prime Minister and the Islamic Seminary. The chosen hero must be popular and courageous, and his relationship with religious institutions must probably be beyond criticism. Talking about security, they have to design a single organizational logo for tactical units, integrate small and large units of Hashd al-Sha'bi into light infantry units, and integrate heavy weapons into sections with dedicated and secure warehouses. By considering a convincing argument beyond the idea, it would be great in 10 years to have forces like a parallel national force, similar to Basij in Iran, to protect sacred shrines that will be partially or completely mobilized at all times. If we consider the influential figures in the history of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and review the approach of the Institute's expert advisors, we come to understand that all of these political, military, and media figures pursue a common goal, which is preserving U.S. and Israeli interests in dominating West Asia.
Henry Kissinger has been a friend of mine. I've liked him, I've respected him, but we've been friends for a long time, long before my emergency.
Henry Kissinger, Jewish, former U.S. Secretary of State under Richard Nixon and convicted of war crimes. Robert Satloff, the Executive Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, specialist in the Arab and Islamic world, and the only non-Arab presenter of the American network Al-Hurra in Iraq. Warren Christopher, Deputy Secretary of State under President Jimmy Carter, Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, private investigator of Arab-Israeli Peace Project. Alexander Haig, NATO's Supreme Allied Commander under President Richard Nixon, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan.
I'm deeply grateful, Mr. President.
Robert McFarlane, U.S. Marine Corps Officer, National Security Advisor to President of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
Arabs looking at Iraq could see...
Richard Perle, Member of Senate Armed Services Committee, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs under President Ronald Reagan, known as American Dracula, one of the main motivators of the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
I do think there's probably a new look...
Dennis Ross, U.S. Representative in the Middle East peace process under President George W. Bush, and President Bill Clinton, Special Assistant to President Barack Obama, Special Advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
By several facts, and fact number one is...
Paul Wolfowitz, the 10th President of the World Bank, Assistant Secretary of State under Bush and Reagan, architect of the U.S. war against Iraq. Will the strategy of this apex resource in eliminating Hashdash Sha'abi be able to realize the Zionist dream of 70 years to form a greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates? Actually, this time starting from the Euphrates. Our Rafidein lions seem to be quite vigilant in the face of Israeli plans.
In the limelight.
With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the U.S. economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of families unable to buy food or pay their rent. We now present you an article written jointly by Christopher Rugeber and Alexander Olson. The piece is titled, Once Again, Job Losses Fall Unequally Across the U.S. Economy. The article has been published by the Associated Press News Agency. 10 months into America's viral outbreak, low-income workers are still bearing the brunt of job losses, an unusual and harsh feature of the pandemic recession that flattened the economy last spring. In December, the nation shed jobs for the first time since April. Once again, the layoffs were heavily concentrated in the industries that have suffered most because they involved the kind of face-to-face contact that is now nearly impossible. Restaurants, hotels, theaters, sports arenas, and concert halls. With the coronavirus transforming consumer spending habits, economists believe some portion of these service jobs won't return even after the economy has regained its footing. That trend will likely further widen the economic inequalities that have left millions of American families unable to buy food or pay their rent. Typically, in a recession, layoffs strike a broad array of industries, both those that employ higher and middle-income workers and those with lower-paid staff, as anxious consumers slash